Radio Netherlands Vox Humana presents The Ode to Joy, a beginner's guide to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. The program features the international conductor Kenneth Montgomery and Radio Netherlands music advisor Hans Quandt. It's produced and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
Kind of energy that is incredibly compelling. It sort of grabs you. It's shaking you around in a big way.
It has hope in it. It has idealism. When you think of something grandiose to celebrate or to mourn, then people come up with Beethoven's Ninth. Let's do the Ode to Joy.
It was a favorite of the Nazi Party. It was adopted by communists to celebrate Marx's ideals. It was played at the fall of the Berlin Wall to celebrate the collapse of communism. And it's currently the anthem of the European Union. Few pieces of music have been adopted by so many disparate groups. What is it about Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the fourth movement in particular, the Ode to Joy, which inspires us? One of Beethoven's best-known biographers wrote, "We need the dream of the Ninth Symphony as counterpoise against the engulfing terrors of civilization, as something to set against Auschwitz and Vietnam, as a paradigm of humanity's potentialities." Perhaps its enduring popularity lies also in the fact that this piece of music reflects the revolutionary ideas on which modern Western society was built. Ideas which Ludwig van Beethoven held dear.
It was the aftermath of, and still the period of a revolutionary time all over Europe. Beethoven was born in 1770, which means that he was a young man at the time of the French Revolution. And all the thinking and the events and the outcome of the French Revolution shocked everybody in Europe. The spirit of the French Revolution. It was part of the daily bread and butter of every thinker, philosopher, also in the power struggle between the nobility of the time and the functions they had and the people around them and the empire and religion and everything. That was very much in upheaval.
the symphony itself goes through a considerable journey. Now, I've done it a few times, and it's an absolutely thrilling piece to do. But I've often wondered, what is the background to all this thought? Now, we know that Beethoven was thinking about this poem by Schiller probably 30 years before, because it was one of the most important pieces of German poetry that had been written in the previous century. There were the two great poets, Goethe and Schiller. But it's terribly important to realize these were extremely big figures in literature. But German poetry hadn't been written very much before their time. We're talking about, say, 1750 to 1800. The poetry that existed before that time was mostly religious poetry. There wasn't much of the other stuff that, say, was being written by the English poets that we all know. So German literature as such, German poetry, was really quite a new thing. And then to have this wonderful man, Schiller, put it in a kind of wonderful classic casing was something very, very special. And then to take this subject about joy. So obviously this is a thing that is kind of obsessive with Beethoven.
Joy, thou spark from flame immortal, daughter of Elysium, drunk with fire, O heaven-born goddess, we invade thy shrine. Let thy magic bring together all whom earth-born laws divide. All mankind shall be as brothers, neath thy tender wings and wide.
Schiller wrote the poem. Beethoven changed it a bit and also didn't set it in the order that Schiller wrote. And that's really quite interesting. Why did he do that? I've been very influenced by one particular scholar, a German called Arnold Schering. And in fact, he wrote a book called Beethoven and Poetry. And it was his theory that a lot of Beethoven's music was inspired by literature. Now, Schiller, Ninth Symphony. Mr. Schering makes the suggestion that not only is the last movement inspired by Schiller, but also the first three movements, the other movements. And the first movement is a very unsettling, incredibly dark movement, full of strange, jagged rhythms and very, very dark colors. And it's not a typical first movement where you would normally go fast. It would normally be a fast tempo. Now, this is a rather steady tempo, but there's an awful lot of drama that happens in it. Schering suggests that that's inspired by Schiller's poem called Gruppe aus dem Tartarus. Tartarus, of course, is one of those Greek nether regions. Whether it's exactly hell or not, I'm not absolutely certain, but certainly dark things go on there.
Schiller wrote, "Hark, like the sea in wrath the heavens assailing, or like a brook through rocky basin wailing, comes from below, in groaning agony, a heavy, vacant, torment-breathing sigh." Beethoven himself was a bit of a wreck at this time in his life. By the time he began writing the Ninth Symphony, he'd been completely deaf for years, and his health was deteriorating fast.
He had all kinds of physical troubles. He did not look well after himself. He had a very bad liver that was infected and was very much neglected during his lifetime. Then there are always stories because he had difficulties in finding a wife, because he was an impossible person to live with, I'm sure. And a very eccentric and completely into doing his own thing and not much an eye for his surroundings or for to be social or whatever. That was not part of his being. But then he might have visited prostitutes and picked up diseases there. And at that time, they didn't recognize them well. They couldn't treat them well. So he suffered like a wreck. Very bad, a moody temperament, which was aggravated by his deafness. Because when you're deaf, you see people talk to one another, but you are not part of it. And also when you're of a suspicious nature, then you feel that you're being talked about, but you don't know what people say. And that must have been helped to him.
I don't think the question of deafness is a very important question. I don't really think it affects how he continued to compose. Because any brilliant musician, especially who's creating things, from really quite an early age, can totally imagine the sounds in their head. You don't really need the instruments anymore because you've been trained to be so expert at imagining sounds in your head. The second movement has got this extraordinary dance-like feel. You know, it begins with the timpani yumpa, rumpa, rumpa, bum, 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 bum. It's quite difficult to conduct. I mean, you must know what you're doing. But it's also glorious to conduct because it's fascinating for everybody. You know, it's got fugue, it's got church music. Oh, it's got so much in it. The searching for the stars.
He broke from being a musician, just working for the church and for nobility. He was one of the very first independent composers. He was very much and saw himself very much as an independent individual. He wanted to create things new, unique, coming from a tradition, but at the same time breaking with that tradition and bringing the tradition further than it had ever been. Also, he saw himself as a unique person that was not a member of anything. He was not part of the church. He was not a believer, a churchgoer, which was most common in Vienna at the time, Roman Catholicism. But he was more like a pantheist. He saw the creator, God, everywhere in nature, in thinking, in the creation of art. So he was an individualist. At a time that it was not extremely rare, but still only an upper layer, an upper crust of society, was able to take that independent position in thinking and doing.
I don't think Beethoven had a conventional God. He certainly had a God. And that, of course, comes out in this symphony. And then the third movement, which is very gentle and spiritual and beautiful, is inspired by the poem Das Glück, which means happiness. Interesting thing is that the words of Das Glück go exactly again with the melody that Beethoven writes. So Beethoven's not only being a composer, he's also showing people what contemporary literature is and contemporary thought. Beethoven is the kind of the first to take this symphonic form, which really was just pure entertainment music, to another degree. Symphonies were written mostly to entertain. This piece does not entertain. It makes you think a great deal. So it's not just a collection of notes or just a poem. It's an awful lot more to it. This extraordinary, searching composer without any compromise. He's just search, 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 search. Let's try to find something even more glorious than before, and even longer, and even higher, and even louder, and even faster than anything before. And he does it in the symphony. It must have been, to the audience of the time, they must have been absolutely gobsmacked.
Well, he wasn't sure that the piece would be fitting for the Viennese public. When he had finished the piece, he wanted very much to have it performed. And then he made attempts to have it premiered in Prague. And then his inner circle of friends, he had quite a number of loyal aristocratic friends in Vienna who supported him, and they convinced him that he should do it in Vienna. And they helped him in setting up that concert. So there was a very loyal following of him in the hall, and he was attempting to conduct from what he could see and from his knowing inside out the score. The success after the third movement, so before the choral final, was so big that the hall bursted in applause, and he was so deaf he didn't even hear it. So one of the soloists had to turn him around for him to see the hall. And then he could only see how big the success was, and that was even before the hymn Ode to Joy would have started. So that must have been an incredible event in Vienna of that time.
Sharing is very interesting about the last movement, because he reckons that it's like a Greek rite, ancient Greek rite for Dionysus, the god, and that the beginning in the distance, you can hear a herald calling everybody to join into these celebrations in one place, and with reflections on the movements before. And you get this extremely simple tune that we all know. I've taken the wrong pitch, but it doesn't matter. It just goes up and down a little bit. It doesn't really do anything extraordinary, nor does it have any kind of rhythmic quirks about it or anything like that. It's very, very plain. And then, of course, we know the rest of the poem, which is about brotherly love.
Around 18, I think he saw the poem first, and he said immediately, I want to put it to music. It was so in line with his beliefs, with that idea of striving for a better mankind, completely free of all kinds of serfship to religion, to the emperor, whatever.
Somehow he knew, by his combination of tones, how to really excite people in a kind of, I wouldn't say primitive, but somehow the way that he just writes down the music really hits to the heart or to the mind or both, everything. It moves you in a very serious way. And, I mean, most people know that tune. Now, doesn't they love it?
That same line of thoughts about peace, about hope, about becoming all brothers, they are so basic. And when religion as such is no longer the answer, because in the past they said, well, it all depends on God. And nowadays we are more assured that when we want a better world, we have to create it ourselves. And that's very much the spirit of the French Revolution. And that's very much the spirit of Schiller's words. And that's very much the spirit of the composer Beethoven.
I mean, the last movement is written in the key of D major. Now, the key of D major is always a key of victory and gloriousness. All these keys meant something. D major is perhaps more victory and glorious, and it gets your blood moving in your veins. It's that kind of key. There's one odd section in it where Beethoven suddenly introduces percussion instruments and the piccolo, and it's in 6/8 time. cha-cha, 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 cha-cha. Now, that's very, very odd music. And he hadn't really written music much like that before. And also these percussion instruments, why? What did that mean to people in Beethoven's day? It meant one thing. It meant the enemy. Or it meant people from far away. This was typical Turkish music. You had triangle cymbals and bass drum. And the Turks were regarded as the big enemies for the Western people, because the Turks had got right up to the gates of Vienna at one time. But these people are also welcomed in to this extraordinary rite, this wonderful celebration.
That's very much in line with the ideals of the French Revolution. All people are equal and we have to find ways to live peacefully and next to one another. And that was very much in contrast with the ages or even the generations before that, when you had to be obedient. 90% of the people were not free. And at that time, in a city like Vienna and in cities like Paris, people began to get a completely different notion of what a human being should aspire to without fear, with ideals, keeping your own identity, being an individual.
All sorts of new ideas had suddenly sprung up. People were becoming more knowledgeable about other spiritual things than just straightforward Christianity, whatever it was, Protestant or Catholic. They were beginning to explore other religions. And of course, Beethoven, though he's a little bit later than the Age of Enlightenment, you could see that these important ideas inspired him absolutely radically.
And these ideas continue to inspire and challenge European society. After a year of great expansion, the EU is now preparing for accession talks with Turkey. The former enemy may soon be officially invited to join in as a friend. And if Turkey does join, it will be to the tune of Beethoven's Ode to Joy.
You've been listening to The Ode to Joy, a beginner's guide to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. The program features the international conductor Kenneth Montgomery and Radio Netherlands music advisor Hans Quandt. The recording used in the program is Frans Bruggen conducting the Orchestra of the 18th Century, produced by Philips Digital Classics. The program was produced and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
If you have comments on this or any other Radio Netherlands program, please write to us at English Language Service, Radio Netherlands, Post Box 222, Hilversum, that's Hilversum, in Holland. Or you can email us at letters@rnw.nl.